It's the election quiz edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Goodbye Roger, Suing for Information, and the Humanist Report with the election quiz. Let's begin episode 206.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of star stuff. We are away from the cosmos to know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, a political science philosopher. Ian, you'll never guess what I heard this week in the news.
What did you hear?
Well, you know how there's been this big issue about, you know, bad meat getting into product, you know, like where horse meat was the big one, right? And actually, IKEA was sort of at the heart of this because apparently in their meatballs, there was horse meat in their meatballs. Everyone went, oh, that's all horrible. Well, they're in the news again for meat getting in the wrong places. Hmm. Apparently, and this strikes right at their home in Sweden, apparently they have lasagna and it's like full of moose meat. To which, of course, you go, whoa. But of course, it's actually supposed to be all moose meat. And what they're having a problem with is apparently some pork got involved in there.
Oh.
Which is beginning to make me wonder, like, when you buy their oak bookshelf, I wonder, like, is there any oak in there at all? Is it?
Yeah, you know, it could just be like, you know, pine or something.
You can never tell with these things. But one thing we can tell is, ding, 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 the witch is dead. Sorry. Margaret Thatcher, thankfully, passed away this week. So in the political sense, I'm glad she's dead. She's a horrible woman. Worst thing that ever happened to the world as far as I'm concerned, perhaps with the exception of Reagan. But to also be fair, she's been suffering for quite a long time with strokes and mental dementia that had come along with that sort of thing. So her suffering is out. She's no longer suffering. Sadly, England is still suffering from the harm that she's done to that economy.
Well, I mean, you know, a human being has died, so we should be respectful in that sense. But obviously, we can criticize the fact that her politics were, I think, largely responsible for some of the current economic problems, shall we say, the world is experiencing.
Well, you know, England, before she took power, was one of the more equals. It had a high Gini score and that sort of thing. But afterwards, high inequality, the poor are poor, there's much more worse things. But she was always a tireless defender of capitalism. She was very much into capitalist, and I think faux capitalist, more corporatist, but I guess that has what comes around goes around.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was looking around at some of the responses, some of the articles, and I saw something that I thought was quite well, fitting, actually. There's an online petition asking for Thatcher's funeral to be privatized and that groups should bid on the funeral and the winning bid should be the one that offers the most services at the lowest cost. Because, you know, given Thatcher and her government and her philosophy, she wouldn't want the taxpayer to pay for her funeral. She would want it to be privatized. And I think this is exactly what she would have wanted, isn't it?
Yeah, no, actually, I would love to come up with some argument for it, but... civilized argument against it.
Right.
But no, you're right. I mean, this would be in keeping with her whole ideals, although she famously had said that, you know, there is no such thing as society, merely a collection of individuals. So maybe her family should actually pay for the whole thing on their own, but they could still go through this bidding process of, you know, maybe even just keep with the theme, corporate sponsorship. I mean, much of the large financial institutions in the city, which is a part of London called the city, you know, owe their existence to her. So, you know, maybe they could put a little logos on her casket and that sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you know, Margaret Thatcher's funeral brought to you by Coca-Cola.
Exactly. Or Citibank.
Yeah. Or...
But, you know, on the one hand, I sit there and I dance on the grave of one, but I have to give condolences. Last week, we lost someone who, may not be a paragon in the skeptic community or anything like that, but definitely someone who is a positive force, at least in a progressive movement.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So recently, film critic Roger Ebert passed away. Ebert, of course, is going to be remembered for a long time for his writing and his, I guess, scholarly approach to film. I mean, this man probably saw more movies than anyone else in the world. He loved popcorn flicks. He loved serious, intense dramas. He loved everything, except for the movies that he hated, of course. I stole that line from his website. Anyway, I thought with Ebert passing away, it's a good time to talk about perhaps some underappreciated aspects of Ebert, and that was, I think he was kind of a skeptic and a humanist, although he didn't really identify as one. So to give a bit of background on him, you know, he was born June 18th, 1942. He was born into a progressive Roman Catholic family. He attended Catholic school growing up. He, in fact, always spoke very positively about his Catholic upbringing. Recently, he wrote, quote, "I learned my core moral and political principles. I assumed that they were Roman Catholic dogma. Many of them involved the social contract between God and man, which represented a classical liberalism based on empathy and economic fairness." So he sort of falls into that left-leaning Catholic demographic, which we've talked about before, does seem to exist and sort of counters the kind of conservative fundamentalist demographic.
Well, that's always been a certain tension within the Catholic Church itself, and which has actually really come to light with the current Pope. Ratzinger apparently is quite famous for his opulency, that, you know, he wanted the best dress he could wear to go out in the fanciest shoes, and he lived life quite high. And there's that sort of idea that the Roman Catholic Church has to show the majesty, the greatness of God. I mean, one of the reasons why, you know, the St. Peter's looks so fantastic is they were trying to see get converts to say, listen, who could make this unless someone who was, you know, benefited by God. The converse, of course, being the current Pope Francis is, you know, the poverty of Christ and the whole you know, being one with the poor people.
Right, the sort of dichotomy of you have a church founded by a homeless person that now has a mansion palace for a headquarters. But getting back to Ebert, so he's always been a pretty outspoken proponent of liberal politics, progressive policies. Some of his most acidic wit has been reserved for conservative pundits that he encountered throughout the media. And perhaps not a surprise, given his support for the political left, it's that he also thought that things like intelligent design was completely ludicrous. He is quoted as saying, "I believe Darwin's theory is not only sound, but is perhaps the most useful theory in the history of science." His response to Ben Stein's stupid anti-evolution movie Expelled is an amazing display of acid wit, and I think that even the most PZ Myers of us all will appreciate his pugnacious, aggressive confrontationalism. He definitely did not mince words. He once called New Agers the creationism of the progressives. Quote, "I move in circles where most people would find it absurd to believe that humans didn't evolve from prehistoric ancestors, yet many of these same people quite happily believe in astrology, psychics, reincarnation, the tarot deck, the I Ching, and soothsaying." So he recognized BS when he saw it.
Well, he even went stronger than that, if I remember correctly, is that he said that if you believe in any of these things, that automatically disqualifies you to be president of the United States.
Yeah. He was... that whole article was all about people like Sarah Palin, Mike Huckabee, and others. And he made some interesting remarks in that particular essay, because he said that, you know, it's not if you want to believe in these sort of things, that's your business. And you should not be, like, barred from serving as a president, but you should not be the president. You know, subtle difference there, right? He also wrote, quote, "In polite company, where fundamentalist or New Age beliefs are expressed with confidence, you have three choices. One, silent agreement. Two, eagerness to contribute your own similar finding. Or three, mentally composing a new answering message for your cell phone." So he's, again, a witty guy, but he's definitely demonstrating, I think, some pretty cool skeptic thoughts. And the fact that he was so well known as sort of not being a skeptic, I think, gives this, I think, more credence. He was always very coy with his own religious beliefs. Many have actually accused him of being an atheist, although he was, until quite recently, didn't really dive into that. But in an article for Salon, he wrote, "I know it's coming, that's his death, and I do not fear it because I believe there is nothing on the other side of death to fear." Which could mean that there is nothing to fear on the other side of death because there's nothing on the other side of death. Or it could mean there's nothing to fear because what's waiting for you is, you know, Catholic heaven or something, right? But he also wrote, quote, "That led me to the subject of evolution, the most consoling of all the sciences, and I became engulfed on my blog in unforeseen discussions about God, the afterlife, religion, theory of evolution, intelligent design, reincarnation, the nature of reality, what came before the Big Bang, what waits after the end, the nature of intelligence, the reality of the self, death, death, death. Many readers have informed me that it is tragic and dreary business to go into death without faith. I don't feel that way. Faith is neutral. All depends on what is believed in." So he actually goes on to discuss how Dawkins' theory of memes gives him great comfort. His ideas, his thoughts will live on in writings and movie reviews and the memories of those around him. And I think that's just really interesting because here's a guy who was raised Catholic. He hangs on to his Catholic identity very strongly, but is taking a very sort of modernist approach to how he'll be remembered. And he's not mincing words. He's saying, I'm going to be remembered through my work, and that's fine for me.
Well, and I remember, too, in reading in one of his articles, and perhaps this is encapsulates a bit of the wonder of science sort of in itself, is that he had said, you know, some call me an atheist, an agnostic, some call me a Catholic, some call me not. He says, really, you know, for me, the one thing that I like is I like the idea of the question of why. And the thing I fear most is someone answering that question. And by that, what I mean is one of the things that is almost always a premise for any scientific skeptic is what's the next question? How can I keep learning more about the universe and learning more about the universe? And the day that there's nothing more to learn, when someone supplies me all the answers, then it's sort of like, well, what's the point? And that's my interpretation of that sentiment, is that he you know, religion offers you all the answers, but he didn't want the answers. He wanted to revel in the exploratory nature of the question.
Yeah, the joy is the journey for, I think, him. It's not the destination. So he has actually said a few things that are a bit controversial, and I wanted to touch on one particular thing. He wrote an article quite recently before he died called How I Am a Roman Catholic. It was mostly about the election of the new pope, but he mentioned how he is still sort of clinging to some of these Catholic morals, including abortion, writing, birth control. "Here I subscribe to an unofficial double loophole often applied in practice by Catholics faced with perplexing choices. Do that which results in the greater good and the lesser evil. I support freedom of choice. My choice is not to support abortion, except in cases of clear-cut choice between the lives of the mother and child. A child conceived through incest or rape is innocent and deserves the right to be born." So, I mean, I think a lot of people, when they heard this, were like, oh, I don't like hearing that from Roger Ebert. But I think that he's still at least being intellectually honest with himself, because later on, if you look at the comments, someone confronts him with this and says, listen, you know, my wife was raped. What if she had gotten pregnant? What would you have us do? And his response was, I have no response to this. I can't answer this question. I don't know how to deal with it. And I think that shows the fact that he's acknowledging that this is just sort of my gut instinct. I have no evidence to back up my claim this is how things should be. And I think that's a refreshing change from someone who would double down and say, no, I'm right. Here's why. He kind of always took this sort of there's too many questions view of life, right?
Yeah. No, and actually, I think that also, I mean, a lot of people who are pro-choice, right, also will sit there and say, listen, I'm against abortion. I think abortion's wrong. But I don't think that I should project my views onto other people. If you come to believe what I believe, then great. But it's no more correct for you to impose your beliefs on mine. And maybe that's where he's going for with this, is he's sitting there saying, listen, I'm not in your situation. If I'm in your situation, my views might change. But more importantly, it'd be wrong for me to tell you it's wrong any more than for you to tell me it was right.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the implication I got as well, is that he's sort of saying, this is my gut instinct, And I still want people to have the choice. It's just I'm going to choose to cling to sort of this holdover of my Catholic faith. And, you know, that's just sort of what he did. But again, I think we can look at his body of work and say, you know, a pretty remarkable humanist and skeptic, and he will be missed.
Boo-hoo. Mm. I'm sad.
Well, Don, shifting gears a little bit, we have some news about science and censorship here in Canada.
Yes. So, the unaccessed to information. Ooh, what a clever title. Mm. Well, it's too early to say things may be getting better in the government providing information. There does seem to be light at the end of this sort of stonewalling tunnel. We often talk on the show about the shutdown of the flow of material from government agencies and employees to the public. Information essential for the operation of a rational democratic nation. Well, in response to complaints jointly filed by Democracy Watch and the University of Victoria's Environmental Law Clinic, Canada's Information Commissioner, Suzanne Leggett, announced her office will be investigating whether the Harper government is living up to the law of the land. In this case, the Access to Information Act, which states that access to information requests must be answered within 30 days, but it does allow departments to grant themselves essentially unlimited extensions. Earlier this year, Leggett publicly explained that even with generous terms given the government, they are still exceeding their own extended deadlines. He noted that the response times have notably increased since the Conservatives gained a majority. So they can create their own sort of extensions, and even when they do that, they don't even meet their own extensions, which is really kind of bizarre. Now, government officials complain the nature of the request and the complexity of government makes them harder to fill out. That's why there's this extended delays. Legault dismisses this statement by stating that there's no clear evidence that the requests are becoming more complex to process. It should actually be noted that improvements in digital records should actually increase the efficiency and reduce the response times for these requests. Besides this complaint, the Information Commissioner is taking the Department of Defense to court over information requests, which the department slapped a 1,100-day extension. That's like 30 days plus 3 years. I mean, that's ridiculous. So the extension is being argued that it's a deliberate obstruction and a violation of the principles of the Information Act. In an interview to the CBC, it was pointed out that by 2011, less than 20% of the access to information requests to the federal departments and agencies were met with full disclosures of the information. So, you know, if you ever see these sort of documents released and they go on the internet and there's all this blacked out area, well, that's what that's referring to. So even when they sort of fulfill with the documents, a lot of the information, and who knows how important that information may or may not be, has been blacked out. So it's perhaps not surprised. So it's perhaps not surprising that the an international survey taken last year ranked Canada 55th out of 93 countries in terms of access to information. In a press release by Reporters Without Borders, a ranking of countries on its Medium Freedom survey dropped Canada 10 points from its previous survey to 20 out of 90. So we're 20th out of 90, and we went down 10 points. The group states that the reason for the drop was due to obstruction of journalists during the so-called Maple Spring student protest and to continued threats of confidentiality of journalists' sources and internet users' personal data, in particular because of the C-30 bill on cybercrime. That was the one that says you either support the government or you're a pedophile. Our access to information law was created in 1983 and hasn't been updated since. When it first was promulgated, it was actually the envy of the world. Everyone said, wow, you guys have done such a great job with this. But now we're sort of like that old man on the corner who's sort of saying inappropriate things at international conferences, i.e. most nations have surpassed our standards, notably updates because of the information technology revolution that's occurred, right? According to the report card issued last year by the Leggett, the information officer, the timeline for requests being fulfilled by the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, the Department of Northern Indian Affairs, and Transportation Canada were all given Fs. And notably, one of the important ones there is Canadian Food Inspection Agency, which is responsible for food safety. And if you remember, there was the big XL food scandal of getting out poisoned meat with E. coli. So again, all this was sort of spurred on by Democracy Watch and University of Vic's complaint about that. Part of this, the Leggett and the information officer asked for, you know, well, what should we change? What could make things better? So in response to the many loopholes that are existing in access to information, Democracy Watch proposed eight particular changes. One, any type of record created by an entity that receives significant funding, is connected to the government, or created by a government law or fulfills a public interest should automatically be covered by the law. So, you know, BC Hydro, which is still publicly owned, isn't it?
We'll
pretend it is.
Yeah.
You know, because it serves a public function, even if it was privately owned, because it is a utility and it serves a huge public function, it should fall under the Freedom of Information Act. Sorry, Access to Information Act. Freedom of Information is an American one. My apologies.
Right.
All exemptions under the Act to provide information should be discretionary, but there should be limits, that there needs to be a proof of harm test, and that public interest can even override these. So, you know, you have to prove that there'd be harm done if this information was released. Right now, there's sort of the default position that, do we have to release this? No, then great, we won't. And that's sort of the default. The Access to Information Law and System should require that every entity covered to create detailed records of the decisions, actions, factual and research, factual and policy research, to routinely disclose the records that they're required to assign responsibility to individuals to both create and maintain such records, and to maintain each record so that it's easily accessible. So essentially it's saying, you know, any piece of paperwork that an entity creates that has to do with its operation should be correlated and collected, and an indexed record kept. The Access to Information Law should allow that anyone who does factual or policy research for the government be allowed to speak to the media and the public about that topic. So if we're paying a scientist to do research, that scientist should be encouraged, actually, to go out and interact with the public about the research that they have done. Severe penalties should be created for not creating the records, for not maintaining the records, or for unjustifiable delays in this. Right now, the information officer that is responsible can give a report, but there's no teeth to the particular act in itself. The information commissioner should be given explicit powers under the act in order to release records, to penalize violations of the law, and to require changes where a department doesn't actually comply with it. So to go in and say, listen, you have a problem here, you need to fix this, and you need to fix it now, or here's how you're going to fix it. Access information system and enforcement should be increased to solve backlog problems and reduce the fees and overall increase standardization, i.e. try and get rid of the barriers that are put up almost artificially to the access of information, that it should be a free-flowing system, and that if you need to put more money into it, that's a very important, it's as important in many ways in Canada, maybe more important than the idea of defense. I mean, this is information democracy needs to get a hold of. And that most importantly, Parliament should be required to review the Access to Information Act every 5 years to correct any problems, to ensure that it's kept up to date with modern issues. So that's one part of it. Then this even gets more convoluted when we factor in perhaps the intentional or unintentional collateral blocks. So Legault, who has been at her job for 3 years, has says that her department has suffered an 8% budget cut. And she has to deal with over 7,000 complaints and has 2,000 left. And with less and less money, she can't do her job. And this gets, you know, cascading down, because if the Canadian Inspection Agency loses 10% of its budget, not only does it not inspect the meat, but it literally does not have staff to get the information that you need to get that.
Mm-hmm.
7,000 complaints in 3 years. That works out to over 6 complaints every day. Legault says that in the last 6 months, she's seen a sharp rise in the number of complaints with the department and about departments and improper delays to responses for access information requests. To which, again, she says it's budget cuts, you know, which leads to staff cuts, which again leads to reduction of service and lack of information. I don't think it's a plot or conspiracy. Well, no, I do. I think to a certain degree, I think Harper has made a conscious decision to say, listen, you know, if there's less information out there, there's less things for people to trip us up on. And as a party, as our election strategy, it's going to be easier for us, right? And I'm willing to set that. But then there's also this other idea that we need to cut back government. And people sort of think, well, you know, my taxes will be lower and that's the end of it. You lose services. And part of the services that we're focusing on right here is to know even what the heck the government's doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it seems like it's a kind of a no-brainer that you'd want to have those services in place. And it does kind of have that veneer that this is so sensible that they will never allow it because it's just too sensible. You know, I mean, it has to be crazy and rigorous and stupid for them to accept it.
You know, and like I say, a lot of these are sort of accidental. I mean, one thing to always remember, for reporters, for example, right? If they want to go out a news story, they have a very short deadline. Mm. So, you know, the government says, well, you know, we've never denied a request of X, Y, or Z. But what they have done is the reporter goes in and says, hey, I want to talk to scientist A. And first of all, to distinguish between us and the Americans, and we always look at Americans as, ooh, evil and all that sort of thing. In the United States, they just phone the scientist up and says, hey, can you talk about this? Here, you have to phone the government official who will arrange for an interview. And of course, when they do that, they got to get approval from their boss and sometimes their boss's boss and so on and so on. So hours, days, weeks, sometimes never. And these delays, reporters just, they can't deal with them. So they say, well, okay, I won't get that information. In fact, there was a little over a year ago, I think now, a very famous report done by a Canadian-funded scientist about the fisheries, West Coast fisheries. And sort of the report had gone out, and they sort of hold on to it for a few days so that reporters can, you know, do a bit of research. They can talk to other people to get a handle on it. It's called an embargo, right? So Scientific America, or Science, one of the two, got this report from this Canadian scientist and said, wow, this is such a big thing. It sent out thousands and thousands of press releases, for lack of a better word, saying, hey, this report's coming out. It's really, really important. You need to get a good handle on it. So obviously everyone tried to get a hold of this particular scientist. And she was not allowed to talk until after it was actually published. And then they did a Freedom of Information Act, one of the ones that went through. And it found out that she was willing to talk, her handlers were willing to let her talk. It ended up going to the PMO's office, and at that level they said, no, she's not allowed to talk, which just really puts a scary spin on the whole topic.
Yeah, it really does. Well, we should take a quick break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll come back with more after this right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
I will say B, Peru.
I'll do it.
And that's your final answer?
Yes.
You could buy a new car. You just want
$33,055.78.
To everyone who donated to this year's fund drive, CITR would like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you to everyone who helped us meet and exceed our goal of $30,000. Your generous donations help us support local artists, businesses, and marginalized voices in the community. Here's to another 75 years of campus and community radio.
In this dot, standing on a planet, really I'm just a speck, compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
CITR presents Artists in Our Midst, a free annual art exhibition and sales event at the Roundhouse Community Center in Yaletown, Thursday, April 11th, and Open Studios, April 11th, 13th, and 14th. For more info, go to artistsinourmidst.com.
Hello,
and welcome back, listeners. Today we have a reoccurring segment, Humanist Report, with Ian Bushfield, who is here holding two hats. One is the BC Humanist Association Executive Director, and the other is, well, just plain Ian. Hello, Ian, and welcome back.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me.
Lots is happening in the humanist world. First, we should talk about the Atheist Church. We talked on our show about the growing movement of the Sunday service in the UK and how they've sort of welcomed the title of atheist churches. I've been reading lately, and apparently this is like a global movement now that's taking off everywhere. I understand the BC Humanists, prior to this, have had, you know, their own sort of regular Sunday meeting. First, what's happening there, and why do you have one?
Yeah, so we found a lot of our members just really want a community. They want somewhere they can come, hear interesting topics, and meet some people who are like-minded. It happened to be that most people who are non-religious happen to be free on Sunday morning, and we found a good venue that we can get on a recurring schedule. So we have a meeting every week on Sunday morning. Now, we don't call it church, but those who are happy to in places like Calgary and London are, I guess, welcome to.
Well, actually, that leads to my second question. I mean, what do you think of the idea of actually calling it an atheist church? Somehow I would have thought you'd reject that title.
I know a lot of our members are against that, and I see that idea. The word has so much baggage, and we're not dogmatic. We're not, you know, a traditional religion, if we're a religion at all, which is arguable. But to me, they're just sort of words, and it's a matter of what are we talking about. So here we're a group that meets weekly, talks about philosophy. And I want to emphasize that it's a talk. It's more of a dialogue. We have lots of questions and answers, and we discuss things rather than someone stands at the pulpit and tells people what to think. So maybe it's not a church. Maybe it's just a group that meets.
We're having an election soon, and a little over a month. It should be all happening. As our good listeners will exercise their civic duties and vote, your group is propagating a questionnaire to help sort of pin down the positions of the various candidates and their views. So what exactly is this questionnaire?
Yeah, so we want to know what the politicians who are running for office in this province believe. What do they think? And there's a number of specific issues that I think secularists and skeptics have. You know, do these politicians agree with the scientific consensus on climate change? Do they support the continued distribution of Bibles in schools? We're worried about these kind of things. So we want to try and pin some of them down.
There's been a lot of talk lately about Christy Clark, how she's kind of been courting the religious groups by being more expressive of her religious views. How do you think that should play into someone's opinion about a politician?
Well, we're not going to use this information to tell anyone how to vote. We're not legally allowed to do that, and we don't have any desire to tell anyone how to vote. But we do want to use it to inform our members and the public of what people think and how they approach politics. My personal view is that our politicians should be basing their policies on the best available evidence and some shared collective, what you could call Canadian values.
I guess that's quite fair. Hopefully they will check out your website, which is, what is it again?
bchumanist.ca.
And check out the questionnaire itself. So you also have another question about the Marriage Act and how you think that humanists should be able to marry equally as a government official or a religious organization. Where did that question stem from?
So we've been fighting over the last while about trying to get a humanist marriage commissioner or a humanist marriage officiant in the province. We applied under the Marriage Act, which allows religions to appoint their own marriage representatives. And we wanted to have humanist officiants. They have these in Ontario and in Scotland, where they're wildly successful. And the government or the bureaucrats denied our application, saying humanism is not a religion. And so we want to see if the politicians would be open to amending the Marriage Act, something they're actually doing in Scotland, because the humanist marriages there are sort of they're classified as religious marriages, but everyone sort of recognizes that it's not exactly. So they're opening up a third category for belief systems. And we're trying to explore if any politicians are interested in working with us on trying to expand our Marriage Act.
But what exactly is the role of the search? I mean, you get your marriage license. Shouldn't that really be the end of it?
Well, you have to get your marriage license in BC, and then you have to get someone to sort of solemnize it. And that can either be a religious representative who is recognized by the province or a civil marriage commissioner. And these are people hired by the province to basically go around performing marriages. Now, the government told us that we could apply to be marriage commissioners, but the problem is we don't then have the same control over our representatives that a religion does. Now, we're not going to try to force humanist officiants to only do certain ceremonies, but we want that sort of autonomy that's granted to religions, but it's not granted to humanists or the non-religious.
Wouldn't it be a more effective ploy to just eliminate the solemnization part of it altogether so that, you know, the license is your marriage and you can have a ceremony, but it's merely cosmetic?
Well, that's definitely the approach that the Libertarian Party gave to us in their response. And that's one of the few we've received already. Basically, the government should just get out of the business of marriage. And it's a compelling argument. But the issue is we've just sort of had thousands of, or I guess in BC, we've had hundreds of years of sort of history building up this marriage system. We could fight for a radical change. Right now we're working on sort of just an incremental change.
Speaking of incremental change, one of the other questions you have on there strikes me as something that I thought had changed a long time ago, in particular Gideon Bibles in schools. And this is probably your most pointed of all the questions. This stems out of Chilliwack, right?
Yeah. In Chilliwack, the school district is currently revised their policy. And last fall, they had a policy on the books that said they could distribute Gideon Bibles to grade fives with parental consent forms. We said that schools shouldn't be using their resources to proselytize for religious organizations. And the school board saw this policy as sort of an anomaly. So they deleted it and decided to come up with something new. And what they passed was a distribution of materials and information policy, which allows sort of broader groups from the public to go into the schools and distribute whatever materials they see fit or that is approved by the school board. We're worried that this is still going to lead to continued distribution of Bibles in the district. Some have said, well, now it's at least others can, but the board themselves had said no one else has ever asked to distribute materials. And so this is clearly not a policy meant to promote education about religious worldviews, but merely a way to continue the privilege of the Gideons.
Do you think that this might be an opportunity for your group perhaps to provide sort of their own counter-indoctrination material?
That's one route we've thought about and looked at. We've generally avoided it because we see the role of schools not as a place to proselytize or to try to brainwash kids into your worldview, but a place for children to actually learn and to become skeptics and to critically think. And that requires a more balanced and secular approach to religion, one where proselytizing and non-proselytizing religions are on equal foot and they can be considered by the children or by students. So if right now, if it's everyone has to go into the schools with their materials, we're sort of all having to compete. And there's many who aren't going to go in there. And so students will be deprived of learning about certain worldviews.
That's true. But wasn't one of the tactics that they used as far as religious symbols during the holidays on public grounds is to try and get as many people as they could to put their own ones to the point where it became sort of ridiculous and they just sort of banned everybody?
I know that's happened in some places. We're working within the BC system. I mean, we have a school act that says all public schools must be explicitly secular and non-sectarian while teaching, you know, the highest moral values. And so we're really trying to push that the schools shouldn't be in the business of promoting any religions.
Well, so that leads into the next question that you have in your questionnaire. Increasing funding to public schools, noble cause, but by doing so, by eliminating funding to private and independent schools. Now, I understand that as far as religious goes, you have some issues, but don't people who pay their taxes have a right to that money to go to where they want? I mean, it's not really private schools you have an issue here. It's just really religious school.
Yeah, as an organization, our major concern is that we want to see, you know, the best system educating our students. We're worried that in these independent schools, many are evangelicals, many are religious, and they discriminate when it comes to employment and when it comes to the students they take in. There was a Catholic school, I believe, in Vancouver a year or two ago that fired one of their teachers because it came out that she was a lesbian. We don't think that those institutions should be receiving public funds.
Fair enough. Now, you mentioned in particular climate change, evolution, but sort of why these? I mean, I understand that one of the foundations of the BC Humanist is the dedication to the scientific method, which is good. But, you know, things that you didn't include were things like, well, the Wi-Fi scare, homeopathy, naturopathy, anti-vax. There are a lot of other sort of non-scientific ideas that
could be taught in school. Wouldn't it be better to focus on the scientific method as opposed to specific yarns? Why these ones?
It just came down to what sort of came up initially in our discussion. We didn't want a questionnaire that went on and on and on, and we just tried to highlight some priorities. Obviously, we care about anti-vax movements and about Wi-Fi scares. I think at the provincial level, we haven't seen the threat from the provincial government on those issues, whereas in the past, they have sort of allowed creationism to creep in. They have taken different stances on climate change. BC, I think, has been very lucky in that both the Liberals and NDP have taken strong stances with climate change. You can argue about how effectively they've been, but at least the Liberals did bring in North America's only carbon tax.
I noted that just a few weeks, I think it was ago, the BC Teachers Federation had tried to put through some language that would, if not ban, severely limit or study the problem of Wi-Fi in schools. That could be an upcoming issue.
Definitely. I think that specific issue was one school district's or one local affiliate of the BCTF sort of trying to push that view. And it seemed to split the union. So we're definitely keeping an eye on it. We're definitely going to try to keep active in that area as much as we can.
Excellent. You have to pick your battles, I guess, is really the ultimate. And you've picked a few, but not all. That's good. Got to keep focused. I noted that you also have one of the questions dealing with prayer before the start of legislative assemblies and that sort of thing. And actually, one of the things that you had gone for is you said as sort of a second case is if humanists would be allowed to perform some of these ceremonies. But could that be sort of seen as a bit of a sellout? You know, that, well, if we're included, then it's kind of okay. In a way, aren't you sort of elevating humanists to the elite group while ignoring the major problem, which is having any form of sort of sectarian presence?
Well, yeah, I completely agree. Like, we split the question down the middle. We said there currently is a prayer. It's really hard to find out what exactly is in that prayer. And so I want to try to bring this out a little bit. This is sort of an issue we haven't pushed very hard yet, but we're going to start to look into. We don't like if it's just a Christian prayer or sort of a non-denominational sort of Christian prayer. That's not acceptable for the majority of BC, which is increasingly non-religious. So the ideal situation would be to just remove the prayer entirely, save the time, and focus on actually governing this province. If we can't get that, then we should have more representation on there, and not just humanists, but every faith community and non-faith community.
Now, one point, and I guess this is more, I guess, an issue of tactics than intent. One of your questions sort of combines what I think are two very different issues. The question in hand is, quote, would you ensure that an adequate course on sexual education, including gender and gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual studies, and how to effectively use contraceptives is mandatory in the first year of high school? Now, I understand that these are both sort of high school issues and they both sort of deal with sexuality, but the one is more of a, you know, an acceptance and prejudicial, bigoted sort of idea, you know, about how gender spectrum people, to give a more general term, are treated versus the idea of sex education. And by putting these two juxtaposition, aren't you kind of playing into the hands of conservatives who would say that the, quote, gay agenda is turning our kids into immoral sex hounds?
Our goal with this is that there are districts in the province where they actively work against comprehensive sexual education. Abbotsford notably has a policy which sort of allows a lot of non-scientific thinking, let's say, to encroach on sexual education. So our hope is to try to ensure that everyone in this province is learning at least some basics. Ideally, LGBTQ inclusive communities will be a school-wide policy that's taken into account in everything, because kids don't stop being gay when they leave sex ed class. So I didn't, you know, it wasn't our intention to overly conflate the two issues or to play into anyone's hands. But I think there is grounds to sort of ask it in one question rather than two.
Okay. So maybe there's something magical about the number 9, because you have 9 questions and 10 would just seem to be too many.
Yeah, we don't have 10 commandments.
So just to round out, like I say, you had 9 questions. The last one that we haven't really covered with is death with dignity, the idea of being able to select the time of one's own death. Now, that's been an issue that's been raised and we've talked about a fair bit. But I noticed there's some other things that you haven't included, like the Idle No More, Keystone Pipeline. There's a lot of other issues. What process did you group use to winnow down to these ones that are important. And these other ones, which I don't want to say are unimportant, but you need to maintain focus, so you chose these nine.
I based this questionnaire largely off of one that we'd put together a couple years ago when the leadership races were going on. So I will openly admit that it might have missed a couple of the more current issues, current events, in favor of things that are a little bit maybe more timeless. I don't know more as a movement is new, but definitely First Nations issues have a long history in BC. Our group hasn't taken an official position on the pipeline. We just haven't looked into it enough. I mean, individual members definitely have, but I don't know. I haven't looked into the science entirely myself, so.
Well, that leads into the other other aspect of this, is a number of your questions are very much, I guess, core humanist things, you know, separation of church and state, right to life, which is, you know, a human caring thing. But there's been a lot of talk lately about quote-unquote mission creep as far as various movements on our side of the agenda. Are you worried that maybe the BC Humanists are going to spread themselves too thin by trying to cover every issue and have an opinion about everything and not really being able to move on any one thing?
Well, I think we have sort of prioritized a number of our concerns. As an organization, our current battles are in terms of the fight for marriage officiants and the fight against the Chilliwack Bibles. That's, you know, what we're actively involved in right now. Our goal with this questionnaire is to just try to raise some awareness of a number of issues that are out there. Obviously, I didn't hit everything, but I tried to hit a number of things that come up frequently. So that's where I went with it.
You're encouraging members to present these on their own to their own local candidate. So how are you going to see what, like, is there going to be a method for you to collect all this information to one so I can just go to your website and I can find out whatever, or is that violating your nonprofit status?
No, so we have put the questionnaires forward to the leaders of every party, of every registered BC political party, and there's about 25 in total. And we're slowly collecting responses as they come in. We've received responses from the UN Party and the Libertarian Party so far, and later in the week, we'll post those on our website. And so we'll collect sort of the major responses, the official party lines, and then encourage members and individuals to go on and collect their own responses. As an organization, or as a charitable organization, we're allowed to do some political work, which this is would be arguably considered, but we're not allowed to take a partisan position. So we're not going to either endorse or oppose any candidate based on their answers. But we're going to put it out there as an informational tool for our members and for the public.
So I'm going to direct this at Ian the person and not Ian the representative of the BC Humanists, because I don't want, you know, there to be too much crossover. But to be fair, this is not there is a right and a wrong answer to all these questions. I mean, in sort of saying that you're not promoting any particular party or whatever is a bit disingenuous, because as I say, there is a definite right and wrong answer to a lot of these questions. How do you think someone... Yeah, how do you square that circle?
Well, I mean, there's answers that I want to hear, and there's answers that I would be less happy to hear. I think for the most part, we're going to see a lot of politicians just try to avoid the issues, because in this current campaign, we have Christy Clark fighting for her party's life, and we have the BC NDP and Adrian Dix just trying to keep things going so they win. Based on that, we probably won't see the NDP take any controversial positions. I don't expect anyone to answer, you know, the right to die with dignity question, because they don't want to deal with it. It's why it has to go through the courts right now. I don't expect anyone to, you know, answer correctly or incorrectly. For the most part, I'm going to be a cynic and expect silence.
Well, okay, so this will lead into the idea that, you know, what do these sort of opinion-type polls mean? I mean, there's been a lot of opinion polls recently about the whole idea of faith in society. One in particular that I've been looking at, and I really have a lot of issues with in some degrees, is the National Post one, which there'll be a link on our page too, which has some interesting things like 72% of British Columbians consider themselves spiritual. What does that really mean? But a lot of the issues with this is, one, what do these words mean? And there's no methodology to this. First of all, what do you think about the recent state of the inflation of non-affiliated people? So people who don't go to any church, don't claim to be Christians, what do you think of that particular movement?
I think it's definitely real and it's definitely growing. Getting concrete numbers in Canada has always been an issue. We typically have to rely on the census long form which comes out every 10 years. So the last data we have is from 2001, and we expect the long-form census data on religion to come out in mid-May, but as part of the National Household Survey. But the problem with that is this 2011 data is part of that long form that was made voluntary. So we won't know if there was some bias that changed in it. So there's going to be some skewing, arguably, in it. I don't know whether that'll skew in our favor or against. The other huge issue with the census data is that the census asks people, what religion are you, even if you no longer practice it? So you get an overinflation of people who are sort of culturally religious. The 2001 census reports that Quebec is over 80% Catholic, but this is the most anti-Catholic province, arguably, in the country, where none of their policies are sort of reflected in church doctrine. So we have sort of a shortage of data. We have the occasional media poll that comes out, like from the National Post, but we don't really have anything that describes what, say, British Columbians actually think. Opinion polling has a lot of concerns because they try to keep it simple, or else it's a complicated study. But one thing that I'm really excited about is the BC Humanist Association is going to be commissioning our own poll for November of BC specifically to find out what people identify with, how frequently they go to church, and whether they can believe in God or consider themselves religious. The British Humanists did a poll like this a few years ago in conjunction with their census, which found a small proportion of Britain was non-religious, but the British Humanist poll found that almost half the country said they weren't religious. So you start to get extra data when you ask these questions properly instead of trying to overinflate religious ideologies like the census does.
Well, actually, yeah, because I'm even going to sort of what's considered to be the hallmark, the Pew Forum, which is quite respected. And even they have that sort of, what tradition do you adhere to, or what sort of, not whether you believe in God or not. It has like Finland is almost 82% Christian, but Finland is one of those countries that's almost predominantly atheist. And, the fact that they may be members of the social church or their families were this, you get a lot of misrepresentation. So the poll that you guys are going to be having, how are you going to prevent this sort of creep from coming in?
Yeah, so we're working closely, because we're footing the bill for this, we're working closely with the polling company to make sure it's both a valid poll and that it's done scientifically properly with objective questions, but also that it asks the questions we want to know and is able to answer them, and in a scientific way. So we want to know, are people religious? And we're going to have them ask these questions. This is going to give us fantastic data that I don't think has ever been really done in Canada, where in one specific province, we're going to be able to break down by region, by age, by gender, by ethnicity, who BC's non-religious community is. We don't have this data yet, and we will have it coming out fairly soon.
Are you going to do what a lot of political parties do? Are you going to have the informational poll done for yourself and keep that quiet, and then have a splash poll that says 99% of BCers don't believe in God, and that's the one that gets all the public press? Because a lot of these are leading polls, and then they do have real polls so that they can adjust their policies, but quite often they'll have this sort of false leader.
Yeah, we're definitely not interested in doing a push poll where we're just trying to get some publicity off it. Obviously, we do want publicity from this poll, and we think there's going to be a lot of interesting data to come out of this, and we'll sort of work with that to make sure that we can present our case with it. We're not going to try to hide the numbers, but we will try to tell our story, and that'll depend on what the numbers come out.
See, it's always been the handicap of people who are dedicated to scientific method, is you actually want to believe in the truth as opposed to the other side, if I can use that term, who just make it up as they go. Thank you very much for spending your time here with me, Ian. Is there any last words you'd like to give to our audience?
Yeah, we're definitely looking for people who are willing to help us support this poll. It's not a cheap initiative, but I think it's a very valuable and exciting opportunity to learn more about British Columbia's non-religious population. I think it'll help us learn whether people actually care about these sort of faith and politics issues, or if that community doesn't actually exist.
So thanks again, Ian, for showing up. Hopefully we'll see you back again when you have some information about the questionnaire.
Thank you, Don.
We'll be right back after this commercial message.
Hi, this is Jennifer Farney, founder of Discorder, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you. Hello, we're back on Radio Free Thinker. Our thanks go to Ian of the BC Humanist for joining us for that. Well, we're out of time, though, Don.
Are we?
So we need to go to our skeptical highlights.
I don't hear the clock ticking.
Tick, tick, tick.
So I have a few skeptic highlights this week. First of all, International Workshop, Capitalism, Inequality, and Democracy. This workshop is going to be held at the UBC campus at the C.K. Choi Building this weekend. It starts Friday the 12th. At 6 o'clock, goes to Saturday until 5 o'clock. They're going to have all sorts of interesting workshops and discussions about inequality, for example, inequality and varieties of capitalism, economics and social inequality, the case of China, inequality and democracy, the case of UK. Good, you know, spread around the world. Mm. The rise of inequality in Canada, causes and consequences, inequality and representation, crisis of democracy, politics under neoliberalism. So that's one of the ones. This is $15 for lunch if you want that. Other than that, I think it's all free. My other highlight is in the same sort of vein. Sorry, guys, a little political this week. Thatcher's dead. Revolutionary Horizons, debating the democratic potential of the internet. So this is from their blurb. The role of the internet and social media in recent global uprisings has received much attention. Popular claims that the social and internet media have become revolutionary tools for social change and are frequently countered with the charges of slacktivism. So, you know, the internet's a great way to do it. It's also a great way to not do anything because you can go home and click on the like button. Jody Dean and Andrew Feinberg are two critical theorists who have contributed much to the development of highlighting the Enlightenment and distinction between particular perceptions of technology and how they work with politics. This event will bring these two esteemed scholars together to debate how we can best understand the role of the internet in shaping the possibilities and limitations of collective action. This is going to be occurring at SFU Vancouver, the Fletcher Challenge Theater, which I believe is part of the SFU Harbor Center downtown, April 12th at 7 p.m. My last one is part of the Space Center's Women in Science. There's a presentation called The Dark Secrets of the Universe by Dr. Stephanie Cote. There's a lot more to the universe than meets the eye. In fact, astronomers have now determined that most of the contents is formed by dark matter. Ooh. And even more mysteriously, dark energy. Ooh. They call it dark because this phenomena doesn't emit any light and therefore invisible to our current methods of detections. This is one of the Big Bang mysteries that Dr. Cote will discuss. This is happening Thursday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the H.R. McMillan Space Center. Tickets are by donation.
Excellent. Well, I got a couple of highlights as well. Quickly run through them here. So the first one coming up is CFI's Freethinker Book Club, The Believing Brain, which is written by Michael Shermer. And the blurb is The Believing Brain, From Ghosts and Gods to Politics and Conspiracies, How We Construct Beliefs and Reinforce Them as Truths. So I think this is apt, given that there's been some discussion about believing brains in the skeptic community, and we all want to know how our brains believe things. So come on out Saturday, April 13th, 1 p.m. at the Grind and Galley Coffee Bar here in Vancouver. Another big event, and I'm quite excited about this one, is the Science of Vaccines, a panel discussion, and this is organized in somewhat response to the shenanigans of the anti-vax group that happened at Harbor Center a couple months ago. This event, happening Friday, April 26th in room 1700 of SFU Harbor Center, will bring together some panelists to discuss, well, vaccines and vaccine science. Why do we need vaccines? What role do they play in our healthcare system? And bring your questions, because this panel will give sort of brief introduction, and then we're going to take Q&A. So it's a great opportunity to learn a few things, ask questions, and we're very curious to see what people have to say.
You kind of get inoculated against the anti-vax movement.
Yes. I wasn't going to say that, but that is one of the
things. One of us had to go down that
road. One of us had to say that. One final thing. I'll just give a quick shout-out, because we announced it today. George Harab, the host of the Geologic podcast, is coming to Vancouver. He's going to be giving a show at the Railway Club, and you can find out all that information, of course, on the event page, harabvancouver.eventbrite.ca, where you can get tickets, and we'll have links to that on our show notes as well. Harab is a really funny musician, I think.
Well, I was going to say, so people who are sort of in the community will know Harab because he hangs around with a lot of other famous people, but I was asking you just a few minutes ago, so who is Harab and why would I want to go see him?
Well, Harab is an enigma of a man.
In 30 seconds.
Yeah. Well, okay, so his music is hard to categorize. It's a bit of folk, it's a bit of rock, it's a bit of everything. His podcast is sort of a surreal journey into science, skepticism, but also humor. I encourage you to check it out. It's quite interesting. His mom is often a frequent guest on the Geologic podcast. She's always cool. And I think it's just a really fun evening. He was here a couple of years ago when the Skeptics Guide stopped by. So it'll be a second opportunity to see him if you haven't already.
Because I like coining terms. Would you consider him to be skeptitanium?
Skeptitainment?
Skeptitainment, that's it.
Yeah, I would say that. He is absolutely. So, those are your skeptical highlights this week. Check them out at ravethinker.com. This is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thank you for listening.
And this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.